Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm just joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith. We are currently, I don't know if stuck's the right word.
Well, we were stuck.
But we were stuck in Big Bear, California, where we both live. There was a big snowstorm over Christmas, which was a lot of fun. It was quite enjoyable to have snow during Christmas week, but it also makes travel down the mountain complicated, to say the least. So there were temporary road closures a couple days ago. And then on top of that, you just have a lot of traffic from LA and the Inland Empire and the whole of Southern California that gets really excited that there's snow and kids have school off for Christmas and New Year's and all that. So it just makes travel difficult. So we're recording what is probably something like akin to an emergency batch of episodes because we just couldn't get down to the recording studio. And I mean, I think this isn't unfamiliar for listeners. This has happened pretty much every year. And if you pay close attention, it happens around this time of year every year because of the snow. And while it's, you know, not ideal, it's sometimes fun to record just an episode in the cabin, staring out, looking at the snow bearing in your car and all those sorts of things. But today what we're going to do because of this is we're going to talk about a book that my dad just, well, didn't just come out, but it came out 6 months ago or so, 6 or 7 months ago or so.
I think it came out at Here We Still Stand, October.
So October, and is a collected volume of essays on friendship called Where Two or Three Are Gathered. I was lucky enough to write in that book as well, and so I think it should be a pretty good conversation. You know, I want to, for 2020, this is one of the first episodes in 2020, we are planning on going back to sort of year one of Thinking Fellows and doing more visitations of books that 1517 is publishing, having more of those authors on the show to talk about the subject matter of their book and encourage listeners to go and read. It was a big part of Thinking Fellows year one and two was this podcast like had a lot of reading homework for people who wanted it. And I do want to return to that format a little bit, especially since I think the quality of the publications coming out of 1517's publishing house has been really good over the last several years. We've managed to publish, you know, a solid handful of quality publications every year that I think are not only good but accessible to people from trained theologians to, you know, really entry-level lay reading. And also we tend to have books in that 170-page like cap, right? Like somewhere between 100 and 170 pages, which means that most people feel comfortable buying it because they think they'll be able to finish it.
Yeah.
Which I think is
it's a doable read.
Which I think is usually a really high bar to entry in theological books because they tend to be tomes when they're published. And they tend to, you know, exceed the 500, 600-page length, and on top of being at page length, be technical for that whole 400 pages, right? And so, you know, for good or ill, I think 1517 has started publishing in a much different model than that, even when we do more academic books. And like I would say, there are some pretty solid academic entries in Where Two or Three Are Gathered, but also some just introductory material.
Yeah, it's a good mix. I mean, definitely the article by the chapter by Dan Dean and Jeff Mallinson and Dan Van Boris, I think, fall on the more academic side. But there's a mix. I mean, I wrote a chapter that's definitely aimed at the lay level, as did David Ruffner, as did Paul Koch. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. I think my chapter on friendship in the New Testament was like a mix between like really basic exegesis and lay explanation of a couple parables.
Yeah.
I think, too. So, but yeah, we'll just start off, I'll just ask some basic questions about the book. But before we dive into the main content of the show, you know, as we start to kick off 2020, I have a couple of requests for our listeners, both longtime and new, if you're a subscriber of the show. And even if you're not a subscriber, number one, I'd encourage you to subscribe to the show. It really helps out because then we get a more solid understanding of how large our listener base is. I understand that some people are not going to listen to every episode, but it's still good to know that you're out there, that you're interested in the content, and subscriptions are the only real solid way that information comes back to us. Subscriptions can be calculated in our statistics more readily than the person who listens here and there without ever subscribing. And so it just really helps us also see what content which particular episodes are being listened to the most so that I can sort of make better decisions when it comes to episodes that we're planning in the future and the kinds of things that people want to hear. So please do go subscribe. The second request would be to, and we haven't pushed for this in a long time, but please go review the show on Apple's podcasting app on your phone or through iTunes on your computer. Apple Podcasts, even if you don't listen to podcasts on there, is actually the database from which 90% or so of podcast applications pull from. They use a database gathered there because that was sort of the home of podcasting for close to 10 years. It was pretty. There was not really a competitor in that space. And so, you know, the way you get pushed up in that directory is through one of the primary ways is through reviews. And so we could really use, a new push of 5-star reviews on there. We have 407 or so reviews right now on the Thinking Fellows.
We're looking for 500.
Great. Yeah, we're looking for 500 in the immediate. And I actually know 1,000 is attainable within the end of the year because we have enough listeners that even if 10% of you really were to go review it on iTunes, we'd hit our goal of 1,000 by the end of 2020. So please do. I encourage you to go there. I know it may be inconvenient, especially if you don't use an iPhone or a Mac, but it is still possible to go on the Apple Podcasts website and go review shows. 5 stars is, like I said, the most helpful because it really helps push us up in the directory. So thank you for doing that. And then finally, I wanted to thank everybody who helped us raise money in the end of 2019 to keep 1517 going, to keep the Think Fellows podcast and all of the shows on the podcast network going, and to support our expansion and growth into both new shows and also giving us the freedom to experiment with ways to reach new listeners in 2020. But one of the things that when it comes to being funded by donations is that while that ask sort of ends in 2019, it starts right back up again in 2020. We need a very similar amount of support from last year to do these things in the year to come. And so, if you could consider donating regularly, you can go to the 1517 website. You can set up a reoccurring donation of whatever amount you deem affordable and acceptable. And you can do that. You can do it in behalf of the Think Fellows, or you can just do it without any note at all. And it really does come around and support all of the projects at 1517. And we're able to use that money to support podcasts as it's needed. So thank you for doing that. And let's just get on into this episode.
Let's do it.
So what need was there for this book? Why collect essays on friendship and publish it now? Why not hold on to it or work on it longer? Why?
So I got the idea for this book because writing books is great, and I know a lot of guys love to do it, but I'm not looking to be sort of the kind of guy that at the end of his career has 40 books. And if it's helpful for me to edit or write, I'm happy to, but if it's not and it's better for other people to do it, I'm happy for that too. But I got this idea while I was sitting in Norway a couple of years ago. I think it was the first time that we went to Norway, and Jim Nestegen was giving a lecture there. I don't even remember the subject of the lecture, but one of the things that came up in his lectures, which sometimes they're always wonderful, but they can sometimes might make you think he's diverging from the main path a little bit. But during the content of his lecture, he started talking about the unique friendship between Luther and Melanchthon. And at that time, I was still lecturing pretty heavily on being dad. My book, Being Dad, Father is a Picture of God's Grace, which is really the only book I ever really wanted to write in full other than my dissertation, which want is strong. And I remember thinking that it was just such an interesting topic, just on that interesting friendship between Luther and Melanchthon. And then all of the lectures I had been giving on being dad sort of broke into ideas of masculinity, which then broke into ideas of mentorship, which then broke into ideas of friendship. And I can honestly say, as I was going about lecturing on being dad to men's groups, the one thing that became a real reality to me was that men don't have friendships on the whole. And so Jim's giving this lecture. I have this experience from lecturing on being dad. And I thought, well, heck, why not do a book on it? I didn't want to write the entire book because I thought it'd be kind of cool to break friendship up into the different aspects. I'm pretty familiar with how Lewis talks about friendship in the four loves as philia, brotherly love. I dealt a lot with that in being dad. It's kind of serves as a good jumping off point, but I thought it'd be interesting to sort of break up friendship in other areas of really the academy, in theology and history and philosophy and ethics, and to have my friends, people I know who are my friends, each take a chapter and take a stab at it. And so that's what we did. Originally, I had intended for to work on a couple chapters with Jim Nestigan, but his schedule is never easy to wrangle. So we ended up doing it with some other people, but I think it turned out great. I did an introduction. You and I together did a chapter on the friendship in Luther and Melanchthon, since you'd been studying Melanchthon in more detail lately. That was fun. Jeff Mallinson did the ethics of friendship. Dan Dean did the philosophy of friendship. Paul Koch did theology of friendship. My friend David Ruffner actually did a chapter on what the title of the book means, Where Two or Three Are Gathered, from the Lutheran Confessions, specifically from the Small Call articles. And then you did New Testament, Friendship in the New Testament. Chad Bird did Friendship in the Old Testament. And then Sam Schultheis did a couple of appendices talking specifically about, say, friendship in the literature of J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and the idea of the friendship surrounded in the group that was called the Inklings, the writing group at Oxford.
Yeah, it's a diverse book, which I think is good because, like being dad, when you go and do these sorts of talks, I was there for one of the first ones you did on this. The immediate questions that always follow are like, give me a checklist.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do? In this book, like, I guess if you looked at the title before cracking it open, you might think this was like 10 chapter book on how to be a better friend.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And
there's really none of that in there.
Yeah. It's more like being dad. And like the subtitle to being dad is Father is a Picture of God's Grace.
Right.
And this book just supplies a lot of pictures of friendship, some concrete historical examples, some pictures from history, some from the scripture, and sort of allows people to draw their own conclusions about that, but guided along the way, right? So not unfounded conclusions, but they're sort of guided to this picture of friendship, which the book proposes is both scriptural and, you know, practical for the Christian life.
But not really common in our current daily life is the other thing I'd say. Man, when I started doing some research on this, it was pretty shocking to me, just some of the sociological research regarding how men these days feel about friendship and how few friendships they report having. And it's just kind of crazy, honestly.
Yeah, it's if you spend time reading comments on anything on the internet, you will see how lonely people are. In fact, there's a lot of admitting how lonely we are, especially if you dive into the meme world and stuff like that. You know, a lot of the jokes people make today, especially people my age today make, are about how alone they feel. Sort of making humor out of that, but it actually reveals sort of a deep trouble that people feel, is that as we have gained sort of the ability to be more connected than ever,
right,
in some ways, we are at the same time becoming as isolated as humanity's ever been.
Yeah.
Because that connection actually allows you to be more independent than you've ever had to be. And there's a level of dependence on other people that's just gone.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, I think that's one of the things that when I think about friendship, I think about people I can depend on. But conversely, that means people I am vulnerably dependent on for
certain
things.
One of the things I talk about a little bit in the introduction is just the fact that friendship is scary, because we're sort of accustomed to, once we get into a romantic relationship, opening up ourselves to that person, and becoming vulnerable to that person with our emotions, our feelings, even our sexuality and the whole nine yards. But friendship is a whole different ballgame. And you end up, when you have even a few good friends, you end up being vulnerable to them in a way that you're not to just normal acquaintances, or certainly not to people on the internet or whatever. And so that can be kind of terrifying, the idea of developing a close enough bond with somebody else that you're vulnerable to them. They know you. Mm-hmm. They know your ins and outs. They know what will get on your nerves. They know when you're sad. They know when you're happy, that kind of thing.
There's a tremendous amount of risk in that. And that might be part of it too. I mean, you've written blogs for several years about sort of like the decline in risk taking and even helicopter parent culture, yeah. which has sort of tried to raise a generation of non-risk takers and removing risk. And that might be part of the story here.
I also think part of the decline is that in a weird way, there's nothing special about friendship. It's kind of a day-to-day thing. If you have a good friend, it's sort of a day-to-day thing. And you're usually talking about, C.S. Lewis makes this distinction in The Four Loves where, you know, lovers look at each other, friends walk side by side, shoulder to shoulder, looking at something else that they're interested in or mm-hmm. talking about something else that they're interested in. But it's a, there's a sort of nitty-grittiness to the day-to-day aspects of friendship that aren't Instagram worthy. You know, when I wake up and text my friend David Ruffner about the chapter I just read in the book that he sent me, you know, I guess I could take a picture of my cup of coffee next to my book and that goes on the internet well, but the conversation is just day-to-day conversation. It's just stuff that we talk about.
And it seems like it's pretty unfamiliar to people. Especially, it seems like friendships or, you know, are more sexualized than ever nowadays too, right? You have, you can't beat around the bush. The sort of more mainstream public appeal of homosexuality makes it so that you look at two guys walking together down the street and...
Well, even the phrase bromance and that kind of thing. That kind of stuff drives me crazy. I mean, I've gotten in some trouble for saying that, you know, I think you can be friends with your spouse, but the purpose of getting marriage isn't friendship. So that's, you know, it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen and that there's not times where you're great quote unquote friends, but it's not the same thing. You know, friendship is with an individual person is optional in your daily life. You can or cannot be friends with someone. You can be friends with somebody for a while, not be friends with them for a while. You can be friends with them for 20 years, get in a big fight and not talk to them. Now, maybe you shouldn't do that. But it's not within your sort of daily calling in life. It's not going to affect that. That's not true with your spouse, right? Once you're married and you're now called to be a husband or a wife,
you got to be communicating every day.
Yeah, and you're not just communicating about the stuff that you're interested in. You're sometimes communicating about the stuff that you're really disinterested in, like the laundry.
I would say sometimes
the 2-year-old pooped today on the toilet or not.
Oh yeah, it's oftentimes stuff you're totally not interested in. And even the amount of overlap of your shared interests can dwindle as time goes on and you got to be more busy with work. And like you said, you have kids, you have stuff to do around the house. But by the time the day is spent up, you know, sometimes you're just looking forward to going to sleep.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, hanging out, playing games, doing whatever that is.
It's not optional. I mean, once you get married, you're committed, right? You're literally before God and other people saying that you're going to, even if you don't feel very friendly towards this person on a day-to-day basis, you're going to stick it through. It's not optional. You're in it till the end.
Yeah. I agree. So let's dive into some other questions here. So in the book, you propose that friendship looks ordinary, but that there's something else. There's a deeper thing going on underneath the ordinary surface. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's kind of what I was saying is that, you know, when, let's say I talked to my friend Aaron about what he's building for whatever new client he has, or we go down there and we're changing the oil on one of our trucks or whatever. It, from the outside in, it just looks like daily life. It doesn't look like any, that's what I'm saying. It's not Instagram worthy, really. It doesn't look like anything special. It just looks like here's life. These two dudes are doing some stuff together. And you wouldn't, if you were walking by, other than the fact that people don't really work on their own cars and stuff these days that much, but in any other time, you walking by, you wouldn't give it a second look because it doesn't look like anything. But it is something else. Mm-hmm. It is a deep friendship that's abided for over 20 years, where I can count on him, he can count on me. We get together, we pick up where we left off in our conversations. The conversations never really seem boring or out of place or strained, you know, and there's something deeper going on there. And then you add in the fact that we're both Christians, and the deeper, the sort of root deepness that does show up in our friendship lives quite a bit is the actual mutual consolation of the brethren, which is our ability to forgive each other's sins in the name of Christ Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, to hear each other's confessions and to forgive one another's sins and to placard Christ to one another, to be a little Christ to one another. That's much deeper. But again, outside looking in, it's just going to look like everyday life.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, I've been friends with my best friend for 19 years. Since kindergarten, and we now live pretty far apart, right? It's like it's eight hour drive, but every once in a while I make it back up to Nevada, and we almost every time end up hanging out for some period of time. And you know, like 9 times out of 10, what ends up happening is there's something that needs to be done to somebody's car. Like there's something broken, there's some maintenance thing, and without question, like he'll either show up at wherever I'm staying and with a bag of tools, or I'll pull up to his, you know, two times ago I went out there, I pulled up to his garage and he was under the car and I had just pulled up to the house and I was like, you just start jumping in. And that's, it sort of has always picked up back up around those kinds of, ordinary things. And the interesting thing about that is not just working on, like you said, it's not just working on a car. I can remember every sort of instance of that, right? It's like, I remember every oil change we've done, every axle we've replaced, and it's happened by chance. Like it's just these kind of things where, you know, if I show up, he can depend on me to just sort of be there and help, and vice versa.
Well, and it's more than that too. I mean, he's recently gone through some very big changes in his life. And one of which he drove all the way down here kind of just to hang out, get a break from day-to-day life and to talk to you and to get some advice and mm-hmm. to get some forgiveness. And,
yeah.
You know, it looks like you guys are just changing the oil, but much more is going on.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's and it's, well, like you mentioned, it's vulnerable. He made an 8-hour trip down here to essentially, like you said, get peace and rest and forgiveness. That's not an easy thing to do.
No.
But
if you have a friend, you mm-hmm. understand how necessary it is and how important it is and how freeing it is.
Yeah.
My favorite story of you with Carson is when you guys are out like playing basketball in front of his house when you're like 15 or something, and his dad pulls mm-hmm. up with a list of yard work or something to do, and he just rolls down the window of his truck and looks at you and says, "Oh, good, there's two of you."
Yeah. Well, that was a funny thing. Like whoever's house you went to wasn't safe from work. Like eventually, you know, it became to the point where like, yeah, if we were at his house, you might have to replace a whole sprinkler system, and if you were at our house, you might have to, you know, go dig up the backyard because the Huskies destroyed something, or a trench.
3 hours reloading shotgun shells.
Yeah, or spend 3 hours reloading shotgun shells. There was like always work to be done. Just again, one of those things too. Like our friendship had like frivolous things like playing basketball and video games and all that stuff. But it all was also around like a bunch of work. Like you kind of like, you know, the sweat of your brow type stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's the case. That's been the case in almost every friendship I've ever had.
Yeah.
Whether it's studying work.
Yep.
Or physical labor mm-hmm. work. That's because, and again, Lewis addresses this in Four Loves. Those are the areas of common interest, right? And that's what friends have in common, is those things that they both do. And work is, you know, we often see work as just a burden. This, if I did another book, this would be the book. But work is a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the blessing God gives Adam in the garden, because Adam's bored out of his mind, going freaking crazy in the garden because he's got nothing to do. Mm. All right, he's got no one to talk to, nothing to do. God's first gamble isn't to give him someone to talk to. His first gamble is to give him a job. Give him a job. It's like when your kid comes in on a hot summer day when they're on vacation, says, "I'm bored, there's nothing to do," and you hand him a broom. You know, God hands Adam a broom. I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, Lord forbid you say I'm bored.
I'm bored. That's why I bought a post hole digger.
Yeah, I'm scared of that phrase. I'm terrified of it. So let's dive into this chapter that we wrote together, because I think that's sort of interesting.
Sure, yeah.
And like you said, it actually, so the title is like Luther and Melanchthon, a Reformation friendship.
Yeah.
And
it might as well be called the Reformation friendship.
Yeah. And according to the beginning of this podcast, this subject was the origin story for this book.
Right. It was. Yep. I thought, Jim and I would work on it.
And so, it's kind of weird to feel like I took Jim Neskin's place, but
I think he'd be very happy about that. Yeah. Actually.
But we worked on this chapter. It was a fun thing to do. And I think one of the first things that's surprising is, if you read a lot of literature on Luther and Melanchthon, you'd sort of begin to wonder, especially some of the stuff that came out mid-20th century, if friend is even the right word to describe them.
Yeah, because there's so much sort of faux controversy mm-hmm. sort of written about by scholars regarding whether they agreed or disagreed on a particular aspect of theology.
Right, and especially concerning Melanchthon, you get a lot of literature that sort of spins him as trying to undermine Luther's work on certain doctrine.
Right.
And so then you sort of see like people who had a mutual goal and then had a diverged path who you would maybe call that stress, not friendship. But when you start to read things like Luther's letters to Melanchthon, especially during some of these stress times where he has disagreements with the way Melanchthon approaches things, even we have in that chapter quite a few citations from letters sent from Luther to Melanchthon while Melanchthon was in Augsburg, writing the Augsburg Confession.
Yeah, they essentially worked on that together via Pony Express.
Some correspondence, yeah. and one of the things...
Maybe Mule Express.
Yeah. One of the things you have to... When you start reading this, and there's quotes in the chapter, if you read the chapter about this, is, you can... If you know anything from listening on our Melanchthon episodes, you kind of get the sense that Melanchthon was an anxious guy, right? He was kind of worried about the things that he wrote down, and he was worried about them even after they were written down and would go and revise them. And a lot of this correspondence is just Luther telling him to chill out.
Yeah. I mean, Luther is usually fairly confident, mm-hmm. And you can see that in his writing, that he's not really worried about how he's parsed a word or anything like that, or whether the phrase is the correct mm-hmm. phrase. He writes it, and even if he regrets it later, he'll say something, oh, that's fine, just burn that one.
Yeah.
And whatever. Whereas Melanchthon really can't ever get over the idea that everything he does has to be basically perfect.
And he believes in the permanence of writing in a way that I think Luther probably acknowledged too, but Luther, like you said, had a habit of disavowing some of his own work.
Right.
Where Melanchthon, I think, as part of his humanism, and especially just the...
Yeah, he knew he'd live forever.
Yeah, his dedication to Ad Fontes, and even the amount of interpretations of, say, Plato out there, or Aristotle, or Cicero, and how everybody was writing an interpretation, he knew that his work would, or had the feeling that his work would one day come under the same microscope, right?
Yeah, and it did in his own lifetime, which was... probably why he rewrote so many things. He was always tinkering, I always say, to try to get it right. But this tinkering often sort of exhibited itself in external angst mm-hmm. over, sort of the wringing of the hands over whether I've said this right or not. And I do think, I think Luther got impatient with that several times. But that didn't mean they weren't friends. I mean, one of the greatest things about your friend is that he's the person that can tell you to shut the heck up, mm-hmm. and that's the person you can hear it from. In fact, I think the kind of candor that Melanchthon received from Luther, and quite honestly, vice versa on some issues, and the fact that they still remained, by both of their accounts, good friends until their death, to Luther's death in 1546, it shows that they were friends, because mm-hmm. they were very candid with one another about the things that pissed each other off about. Luther would say that Melanchthon's constant hand-wringing frustrated him, and Melanchthon would say that Luther's constant shooting off of his mouth frustrated him. Mm-hmm. they spoke daily, and they
they
were great friends.
Yeah, and that's sort of one of the things that is just undeniable here is they had a a relationship where to one another or to others, Luther would refer to or Melanchthon would refer to Luther as his father.
Yeah.
In many circumstances, right? Yep. Like this, a very personal relationship, yep. Not just colleagues at the university. And, you can see how that goes. One of the, they weren't contemporaries in age, really. Melanchthon was a young gun when he came to Wittenberg. And if you know anything about amped up young scholars, it's, they can tend to, be, need a little guidance.
Yeah.
Need a little older wisdom.
Yeah.
And, Luther was that wisdom probably in the academy for him in the way that Melanchthon refers to him, but also in the Reformation, he had been fighting the fight for, several years before Melanchthon sort of also began fighting the fight.
Luther had been, not as much as after Melanchthon gets to Wittenberg, but had been in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
With Melanchthon before Melanchthon got to the university. Now this certainly picks up after he gets here, and it's one of the interesting things I think is how little scholarship has been done on the influence of Melanchthon on the early Luther. We sort of always sort of get
post Augsburg sort of what he does to Lutheranism.
Yes, but this sort of how big of an influence was Melanchthon on Luther in 1519?
Mm-hmm.
Is a question. We know by 1521 that Luther is already saying this kid is wicked smart. Like he literally says in a piece of correspondence, I follow him on almost everything.
Yeah, it's in the book. I don't remember the years. I think it's the mid 1530s. Luther says that he trusts Melanchthon's writing more than his own writing, because that while he sort of thinks on the spot and just writes as he thinks, Melanchthon has organized these things into a way that Luther says he wishes he could.
Right.
And so some of that too, when you wonder how much does Luther agree with changes or writings that Melanchthon's making in the 1530s, late mid 1530s, Luther sort of acknowledges that, he doesn't have, over disagreement with him. There's quibbles, but he also thinks that Melanchthon is just simply more clear of a writer than he is and has a lot of respect for him in that realm.
Certainly, his thoughts are more organized. Certainly he spent the time to try to find the exact right word. Whether he does or not, that's, I think, up for debate, mm-hmm. but he's tried to. Whereas Luther, a lot of what we have even written from Luther are lectures. He's great. He's amazing. He's brilliant. And he's the guy that you want on a Q&A panel because he's going to be, insightful and entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
If you're writing like an encyclopedia of Lutheran theology, you might want Melanchthon to take a peek at it because he's good at that kind of thing, and it's, they were complementary to one another for sure in that way.
Which is one of the conclusions of the chapter is that their friendship was vocational.
Right.
It's just a point that in his book, Bound Choice and Wittenberg Theological Method, Dr. Robert Cold makes a point of distinguishing Luther as the preacher and Melanchthon as the teacher and how those two things were synchronous in the instruction and the formation that took place in Wittenberg for all the students who came through and what eventually would shape into Lutheranism as a confession of faith.
Right. Yeah.
And so you sort of don't have, the theological method that, Lutherans confess without these two men working together in their vocation.
Well, yeah. You don't have the theological method that produced the Lutheran Reformation and eventually Lutheranism without what both of these guys brought to the table.
So I think it's an interesting chapter to read. If you care about the history of Lutheranism at all, I think this is a pretty unique entry in this. There, even when we were doing research for this, there's not like a lot of specific articles there are here and there, but I think this is probably one of the most accessible, if not the most accessible piece of writing on this subject
for people. That's probably accurate.
Yeah. to get a hold of. So
you might find a magazine article from 40 years ago or something that's,
and there are some done, journal articles here and there that, yeah, you know, we found, but, you know, just not stuff that people would come across really easily unless they were researching for it. And so I think if this is an interesting subject to you, you know, the book might be worth it for this chapter alone.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about a little bit more about the fact that you've gone and spoken on this subject now a couple of times. You're available to speak on this subject.
Yeah.
You can go to, on our website, there's like a contact space for request a speaker. It's under the About tab. You can click that. And, you know, if you organize education at your church, you are available to speak, maybe not like right now, but, you know, there are open availability that you can work out with us. But as you've gone to churches, and the couple that I've watched you do in this, like I said at the beginning, the question is always like, how can we pull this off, right? And I've seen at the last church where we were at that we did this, there were a couple people who started answering the question for themselves in the congregation, which was very interesting. And it was actually exactly what I would have guessed if you had asked me to guess what people would have said before I walked in there, which was the church creates new
programs,
organizations, maybe even rules in some cases that try to force men together.
Right. Well, I just watched an icicle fall.
Like 30 feet?
Yeah, out of that window. That's pretty cool.
How do you go to a church, you speak about friendship, the whole room, you can see it on their face, understands that this is a need. Many of these guys are missing it. They feel like, hey, the church can do something about it. But then the answer is like a committee.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's...
I think, how do you, do you know, I've come to find that it's inevitable, because as many times as I come in, it's with being dad stuff too, as many times as I come in there and say, listen, I'm not coming here to give you a checklist of things that you guys can do to make this better. The only thing I think you can do to make this better is to change your mind on it. In other words, to come to believe that this is important. And in believing it's important, communicate its importance to others and maybe do some things differently in your own life to support that change. I don't think it's wrong for, you know, when I come into a church to say do something on masculinity or men's involvement in the church or friendship or being dad, for them to say, that's great, we should make our men's ministry more vigorous. And that's not bad. I just don't think it's what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say here, and just for the gist of this podcast, is that, listen, this is important. And this is something that's missing in our world, especially among men. Friendship has almost disappeared. I usually give the example when I start out the lecture of, this is a person. When we talk about good friendships, or even when sociologists ask the question, how many friends do you have? What they're asking is, how many people other than family could you call when something seriously goes wrong in your life to talk about it? Like seriously goes wrong. Like you, somebody dies or, you know, your house burns down or whatever, you know, seriously wrong. Who could you, and not even to come save you, not even to come like with their truck and get your furniture.
Just like to talk it through. Even.
Yeah. Yeah. And when men these days are asked that question, you know, very, very few of them can say more than one. And a lot of them could say big goose egg, zero. And what I'm trying to say is in this book and in these lectures is we're missing out. Like we're missing out on, you can get, and this Lewis says in Some Four Loves, you can get by your whole life without any friends like this. You can survive. This isn't a matter of survival. This is a matter of quality. You can get by your whole life without this, probably. I'm going to add a probably to Lewis's comment. But what will your life look like? You know, and I'll speak specifically to guys here, if the only person you ever have in your life that you can talk to is your wife, you know, who do you talk to when your wife is driving you crazy then?
Yeah, or something happens to her.
Or something happens to her, or whatever. You know, are your kids taking on that burden solely by themselves? Or is it important to have these people in your life? And I think the answer to this is yes. And I think the sociological data tells us that men more than ever are depressed. Men more than ever are suicidal. And that they, you know, they're trying to figure out exactly why, and preliminary findings are finding some connection to this other sense of loneliness, even if they're married and have a family, this other sense of loneliness to the depression and the suicidality. And I don't think that's good. I've sometimes said in these talks that, you know, I'll have 100 people in a room and I'll say, I'll bet you every single person in this room can give me the name of a man that they were close to that committed suicide. And not every person in this room can give me the name of a woman they were close to that committed suicide. And in fact, I'll bet you it's only about 15 to 20% of the people can do that. But almost 100% of people I know can think of the name of a man they were close to that committed suicide.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that is interesting that I think about it too. I mean, just for myself, I could say yes to that and no, I can't think of a woman I was close to that.
Yeah, I mean, suicide. I personally could name three.
Which is anecdotal a little bit, but still at the same time, when you go around and you ask enough rooms full of 100 guys that question and the answer is the same, you sort of get a sense of the thing.
Well, it is anecdotal, but what's not anecdotal is that men are 3 times as likely to commit suicide than women. Mm-hmm. That's not anecdotal. That's just the numbers.
So, you know, and I would add to this too, you sort of at the, like, you know, I keep mentioning this last one that I sat in on, but you pointed out to somebody who sort of wanted a checklist, like, I think you confronted it, not aggressively, but pretty directly. Just go do it.
Yeah,
like,
just go do it.
You like literally looked at him and said, "Well, just go ask one of these guys out for coffee or lunch."
Yeah, what's like, stopping you?
Why do you need the like? Because he kept pushing on a group and group and asking you how you would form the group, and you said, "I wouldn't. Just go do it." Like, if you want to go talk to one of these guys, just go talk to one of these guys.
Yeah, that's hard when it's a men's group that has asked me to come talk.
Yeah,
but it's funny. A lot of the guys when I do men's groups, a lot of the guys in those groups will tell you that they don't talk to each other in between. Mm-mm. Men's groups active. Now there's a couple of churches I've been to where that's absolutely not the case, where these guys are like buds. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, that's not the case.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I would add that to this podcast too, for somebody who's like curious about a list here, just go do it. I think we said that on the New Year's podcast too, because we have a podcast that came out New Year's Eve and we talked about resolutions and we said, hey, if you know there's something wrong in your life, just go do it. Just go fix it.
Yeah.
Right. And I get it. Sometimes this isn't just adjust, right? Like it could be complicated to pull certain things off. But in this case, you know, if there's somebody who you think, if you think you need a friend and there's people at your church who you're surrounded by who you think you should get to know better, don't wait for a committee to be formed to start a men's group or don't wait for the men's group to be more active. Just go ask that person out for coffee or lunch or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's we say just to that, but in our day and age, that's an intimidating thing. I mean, I found that out years ago when I had this, I was giving a talk and I was doing mentorship. And this old guy is like, well, what are you telling me I'm supposed to do? And I said, there was a guy your age there. I said, do you know this young man's name? He goes, no. And I said, well, maybe you should find it out and take him out for a cup of coffee. And he's like, what would I say to him? And I said, well, maybe just start by asking him what he does for a living, what he's interested in. When he reveals to you that he does something that you couldn't do, say, wow, that's great. I'm glad you're doing it. I'm proud of you for doing that. I could never do something like that. I mean, that's the type of thing that I've had older mentor men in my life tell me that changed my world. And I'll end with saying on that, you know, we underestimate how much little things like that will change the world of someone else, especially from an older guy to a younger guy. I mean, if one of the older theologians we hang out with came up and told you, Jim Nestigan comes up and tells you after reading something that you wrote that he's proud of you and that he's glad that you did that, that he's never done something like that. And he's glad that you, man, that would change your world. At least
it sure would.
For a good while.
Yeah, it really would.
And it costs nothing from him to you to do that.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. So, yeah, I think, I mean, that would be the encouragement that I would give the same to. Like, if you have the opportunity, strike while the iron's hot, you know, I don't know, I think that's a good end to this episode. I can't think of much else to say besides go buy the book.
Yeah, check it out. It's an easy read, too. It's one of those books that you can read in parts, too, and if you, one of the parts isn't interesting to you, you can pass it up and you're not going to miss anything. It's not like in sequence.
That's kind of one of the great things about an edited volume. Yeah. Unless like the majority of the chapters are uninteresting or bad or something like that, like it's usually pretty redeemable because there are each separate entries, right? Like I said, if you like you know, the history of Luther and Melanchthon and the Reformation, you'll probably like that chapter, and the book will be worthwhile. If you
like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, you'll probably love the stuff by Sam Schultheis.
I like edited volumes for that reason.
Yeah.
I've contributed to Handful. I've put out the small booklets for Here We Still Stand. It's a fun thing, and I think people benefit from the multiple voices. So, yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes, both for the 1517 shop and for Amazon, you know, however you would prefer to purchase that. And, again, please do remember to go rate the show on iTunes and your favorite podcasting app if they support ratings. Not every single one does. Subscribe to the show if you are a longtime listener or a new listener who's interested in hearing more and hearing it more regularly. And thank you for your year-long support of the Thinking Fellows in 1517. Lastly, thank you for listening to this episode, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.